I love scotch. 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 Scotch.
Yep. Have another whiskey.
If you'd like to speak to me in person, press 1. If you'd like to order drugs, press hash.
I had a gentleman in the crowd that was like, tell me how to drink Glenfiddich. And I was like, I will not do that.
Yep.
You drink Glenfiddich how you want to drink Glenfiddich.
Wear a cowboy hat in Los Angeles and look at the amount of looks you get.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. This is the most flamboyant city on earth. You wear a cowboy hat, people look at you like you are like an alien.
The Beatles came on and they picked me up on his shoulder. George Harrison is as close to me as that wall now. I went, all right, George, all right. And he went, f*** off. And that was the closest I ever came to the Beatles.
Have a whiskey while we...
Yeah, let's do it again.
Yeah.
Cheers, long.
Cheers. Welcome back to United States of Dramerica, and this will be a fun episode because I've got an interesting Scotsman who has an interesting job, or should I say jobs. Welcome to the podcast, let me get this right, Ecolux traveller, TV show host, whiskey ambassador, frankly, Scotland ambassador. Welcome to the show, Ricky Crawford.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. You said an interesting Scotsman. Are there any other kind?
Well, look, I think... sometimes we don't get to the whiskey till about halfway through, but actually I've had a long day already, so let's just crack on straight onto the whiskey. What have you got at your end of the Zoom and green screen?
I've actually dug into my history a little bit to where it all started for me, as we'll find out later on in the whiskey world, and it was Glenlivet. So I thought I'd take a little trip back down memory lane, and I've actually got the double cask right here.
Very good. So... I try and pair my whiskies with my guests. I was going to, because you're from Paisley.
Yes, that's cool.
I was going to have either a Glengoyne or a Glenturret, because they're all within 20-odd miles of where you're from. But actually, I decided not. I'm just going to have a really nice whiskey that I haven't had before. So I'm sharing it with you because, obviously, because you've worked in this world, like me, you will have been the recipient at various times of samples, which is a strange world. You know, obviously, normally you drink whole bottles, but I rather like samples. And I've had a sample in my sample cupboard for a while, and I'm going to open it now. So it's the usual sort of little vial that is, you know, if you're not careful, you put it next to your urine sample, you can't tell the difference. But actually, it's an amazing whiskey. So it's actually a Blatnock 25. Right. So it's part of the Alexander Murray independent bottle range, but it's Blatnock 25. So this will be nice. If I can open it, it's whack.
I believe that's the most southern distillery in Scotland.
It may well be. Look, you're more Scottish than I am. So, right. So I'm going to pour myself one of these from the bottle.
Did you say it was a 25-year-old?
Yeah.
Oh, look at you going big.
Well, only because, like I said, because you're a luxury guy. You're not just, you know, a normal Scotsman. You're an Ecolux traveller. So I thought I should treat myself to a whiskey that's not young.
You know what's funny about that is if any of my friends do get to hear this from back home growing up, they would just rip me apart. Luxury? Who does he think he is? Luxury?
So look, I want to go into the luxury bit first. And so... you have a Amazon TV series. So it's called Leave No Trace. Now, if you Google it, you have to be slightly careful because if you go to the first reference, you get a 2018 movie about a military veteran who's in the woods with his daughter, which is apparently the second movie behind Paddington 2 to get 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, wow.
There you go. But the second reference on Amazon after that movie is your TV show, which is... now, you describe it as Ecolux, so it's as a lot of shows are actually now, it's about sustainability in travel, but the difference is yours is sustainability in travel, but still, how do you have luxury within that? So tell me a bit about the sort of thesis behind that show.
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of the genesis behind the show. We actually, the show started as a show called Out of the Ordinary. Me and my business partner in Sydney, Australia, who's pretty well-known producer himself. We had this concept for a television show where we go around the world showing the utmost in luxury experiences, like really, really out of the ordinary. Almost like, who was the Australian guy years ago? Lifestyles That Are Rich and Famous, that kind of approach. What we were finding as we were shooting in these locations we're starting to find out a lot about some underlying programs that some of these destinations or these resorts or these organizations were running from a sustainability point of view and an environmentally friendly point of view and a social responsibility point of view, putting back into the community. So there was those three pillars of giving back and sustainability. And we just thought it was really important to highlight it because a lot of these companies were doing this with a detriment to the bottom line. For the most part, they didn't have to do it. Like, it's not like they were forced to do it. They would have went out of business if they didn't. And it was costing them money to do it, but they felt so strongly about doing it that we actually felt that should have been highlighted. And that's where the concept, we sat down and said, look, these shows are amazing. We're doing incredible stuff, but let's highlight the eco aspect of it. And that's really where the show started. We switched after about episode 3 of shooting, kind of scrapped that whole TV show, to be honest. There's a few episodes out there that might end up somewhere one day. But then we started shooting Leave No Trace. And we've got 10 episodes total, 7 of which are on Amazon Prime right now.
And do you think, because obviously, you know, the world's moved on, companies need to worry about carbon footprint and, yeah, and, you know, you can, when you book your flight, you can do offsets, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. We've had this weird year, and I don't want to overdo talking about the pandemic because we've all had enough of that. But obviously, travel has almost ground to a halt, and it's going to restart again. Now, we hope it might be in the summer, but it might be Q3, might be, you know, who knows when exactly. When it starts again, do you think that we'll see things differently? Because people were talking about sort of seeing dolphins in the Hudson and fish swimming in Venice that hadn't been seen before. And you know, places have become cleaner because they haven't been covered in tourists. Yeah. When life starts again, do you think this will be refreshed and eco-tourism will be more important because places have paused and had a break and they want to be protected in a different way?
I really do. I think people will look at it from a different perspective. I think people will appreciate it more now. And now it's almost like you're getting a second chance with some of these places. Like, seeing the difference with people not being there, knowing that that's how it should be, should trigger something that says, okay, when I go there, I should do my very best to make sure we don't get back to the place we were before, where the dolphins weren't swimming up a certain part of the river or certain things, certain wildlife, or there was some rivers that weren't running a certain way because there was so much interference with people being there, with human interaction there. So it's almost like we've had the opportunity, not a blank slate, I wouldn't say that, we haven't gone back that far, but almost like an opportunity to get a little bit of a kickstart, a restart.
And when, you know, particularly at the luxury end of travel, you're trying to present people something that's authentic, but also you know they need a certain level of luxury. But in some places, those things don't exist. So in a way, particularly in the more remote places, by giving them the luxury, you're almost actually then taking away the authenticity of the place. So how do you balance giving people who've got lots of money and expect something?
Yeah.
How do you balance that with actually the thing that they're there to see?
I think the first thing you have to do is really define the luxury aspect of it, right? And it's a luxury experience. It doesn't necessarily mean that it is the highest cost, right? It just means that it's something that is available to limited people, whether they have the ability to get there, the ability to stay there for a certain period of time. So it's, I think sometimes you have to define luxury. I have had to define luxury many times in interviews that I've done, just to tell people this is not just about a cash. It's not, luxury is not about cash. It's about an experience that you get that not a lot of other people will get. And what we didn't want to do, when you say the term ecotourism, a lot of people automatically think of mud huts and eating berries and being barefoot the whole time. And that's not necessarily the case. You can go, you can indulge. You know, if you have a little bit of extra spending money, it is okay to indulge, but don't indulge and be ignorant. Indulge, and you probably have the means more than anybody else to actually help some of these places out. So a lot of times we saw that visitors to these luxurious destinations, or these destinations were quite philanthropic when they left. They may have been philanthropic before, but where they had been, they were quite happy to send money back or give resources back in order to keep it the way it was when they were there for future generations. Because it's a fine balance. You know, you want people to come visit, but because what's there, but you don't want everybody to come visit, ruin what's there, because that's what they went to see in the first place.
Yeah, 100%. So look, I'm not going to ask you what was your favorite place to visit, because that's not the right question, but maybe which place that you visited maybe tells the story of what you're trying to achieve in the show the best.
Yeah, so actually the last two episodes, out of the 10 episodes that will air, the last two are in the Maldives. And I don't say that from a point of view of, oh, it's the Maldives, that's the most luxurious, and visually it's really, really stunning. And it's what everybody thinks is the ultimate vacation. Private Island is one of their locations. And then there's the whole over the water experience where they have these amazing villas over the water. But the organization in the Maldives that we went to visit, Seniva, the Seniva organization, is the pinnacle. I think they have set the standard for all of ecotourism, luxury or not. They are actually carbon negative. So they do so much. And I'll give you an insight into some of the things that they do. They actually offer free stay. Like, you can pay to go for 4 days, but they'll give you another 2 days if you offer to go clean up the beach, right? So that's just a very obvious example. They have eco centers within the locations where they do all of this amazing recycling. They've taken, and I'll give you another example. Because they're in the Maldives, a lot of things are imported into the Maldives. You know, 99% of the Maldives is underwater. It's all a string of very, very small islands. So everything has to be imported. It's very expensive. Most of the stuff that's imported is imported in very unsustainable materials. And one of those unsustainable materials are those, you know, those polystyrene boxes like you get as these little coolers that they break off, and they break off in little different parts. Well, they're actually taking as many of them as they can when they get delivered, whether it's food or other items, and they add this other organic material to it, and they actually make bricks out of it, like cinder block. And all of their buildings, the foundation of all the buildings, is this cinder block that they use. So that's just one of the things they do. They recycle all the glass, they crunch it up and use their glass. They burn a lot of the materials they use for their villas, that the main posts are actually used telegraph posts that they bought from countries that were just going to throw them away. So they have done everything they can, and I haven't seen anybody do it better than the Seniva organization. And I don't work for them. I know that sounds like a big plug. They were just so impressive. And then the Maldives, that was just really, really, really beautiful. We're editing the show right now, and I sit there and I look at it, and I'm like, oh, I just want to go back.
Yeah, no, indeed. I remember there was a story, I think it was the Maldives, at the end, I think it was end of March or April, there's a story about, I think it was a South African couple who got stranded there. Yeah. And it was an extraordinary story because I think the resort had promised to keep everyone working until the last guests left, but they couldn't leave for whatever reason, because there was no flights back home. So there was this weird thing where it was like two guests and 20 staff, and they got to spend like 6 weeks. And I think it sounded like paradise, but actually became not to be paradise by the end. But
I think that might have actually been Seniva Johnny. I think that was their over-the-water experience. I think I saw that story, yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So obviously you're from Scotland, for those who listen to these accents. Now, the beauty of Scotland is the nature. Yep. And I know you obviously did an episode in Scotland, but I know distilleries try and play their part in the eco story. Just talk to me about the Scottish episode and what Scotland is doing in this space to try and preserve itself for its visitors.
Yeah, well, Scotland, we actually were very, very specific location in Scotland. We went to the Outer Hebrides, which is a very remote part of Scotland in itself. So it's actually a little easier for them to be a little more sustainable, so to speak, and have less influence. The Hebrides are only accessible by ferry, So the amount of people that can get to the Outer Hebrides is limited by the amount of ferries that run every day and the amount of people you can put on them. Unlike the Isle of Skye, which I guess at one point in, what's the big travel magazine? Anyway, it was the number one destination to visit. Now, the Isle of Skye had a bridge built from the mainland about 20 years ago, a bridge that went over just a little bit of water that used to be a ferry every day. So it meant it was very, very accessible. And they're dealing with some problems, double-edged sword for them. Great for tourism and the dollars coming in, but it has played havoc with the environment there and their resources to be able to handle that many people. But yeah, we did the Outer Hebrides. Scotland is huge on clean energy. We've got the raw material. We got lots of wind. Anybody who's ever been to Scotland knows that it's windy, especially on that west coast. So we managed to harness a lot of wind energy. Solar, maybe not so much, but you know, we get a lot of cloud in Scotland, so not so much. But what I did find out was when I was in the Hebrides, we can actually create the energy to run the whole of the United Kingdom. That's not the problem. The problem is transporting it from the Outer Hebrides to the mainland, right? So we can capture it all, but we can't transport it. So that's where the billions and billions and billions of dollars come in, where it also almost makes it not cost effective. So that was very interesting to find out. From a distillery point of view, Scotch whisky has always been a very clean energy, in my opinion, because any distillery, any good Scotch whisky, people will tell you, you know, one of their main ingredients is the water source, right? Where is that water source coming from that distillery? It's one of the defining factors at the very beginning of a whisky's story. And you bet that the people who are making this whisky, in order to give a consistent product, are going to make sure that nothing is happening upriver. You know, the guys from McAllen are not peeing in Glenlivet's river. the River Spey, in order to make their whiskey bad. So the Scotch whiskey industry, I think, have always strived to make sure that they're not having huge impact, because it matters to the final flavor profile of whiskey. And then with innovation now, there's several distilleries in Scotland who are managing to harness the heat created from the distillation and convert it into energy to power local communities and villages and stuff like that. So yeah. Scotland is in the forefront of clean and renewable energy.
The only thing that's missing is if you could find a way of harnessing the energy or even the food source of midges, I imagine there's quite a lot that you could do. You could power all of Europe.
The midges. And for your people who are listening, I'm sure they know, but the midges are basically Scotland's mosquitoes with teeth-like jaws.
Yeah. So let's talk about, while we're on whiskey, tell me your sort of whiskey journey, because you were, I don't want to age you, but you were a whiskey ambassador before whiskey ambassadors really began to exist properly.
Yeah. I was one of the first, myself and a couple of others, Simon Brooking, who a lot of people, I'm sure you know, with Laphroaig, and a lot of other people know in the whiskey industry, were, as the position of ambassador exists today, we're kind of some of the first ambassadors to come in and do the job that we did. What brands were doing previous to that was they were locally hiring local actors and stuff like that, giving them a little bit of a script, asking them to sometimes put on an accent, wear a kilt, and say, you know, deliver our brand message. But because it was different in every city, it wasn't a consistent message. The brands realized, you know what, we need to find somebody who delivers a consistent message. And I became the national brand ambassador for Glenlivet. I like to tell a little story that I actually spent the first 2 years of my life with Glenlivet with no fixed abode. I lived in hotels for 2 years straight. I was living in Dallas, Texas at the time for a year. And when I started with Glenlivet, they wanted me to move to New York, but I was the position, not necessarily me, but the position was such a commodity for all of the markets. Like, oh, we want to get an ambassador in so we can, you know, help sell a product in our market. For 2 years straight, I was just on the road, which I thoroughly enjoyed. In fact, the first time I went back to the apartment in New York, when I got it, I was like, my bed's not made. There's no chocolate on the pillow. What kind of life? How do people live this kind of lifestyle?
Extraordinary. So, because obviously, I know plenty of whiskey ambassadors, and you know, in some ways, if you don't want that sort of lifestyle, it can be very hard. You know, if you've just started a family, or you know, you're on a diet, it's, you know, it's not a great job for that sort of thing. But if it's at the right time of life, and you know, I was a sports journalist when I was younger, and it's an anti-family job when you're older. When you're in your early 20s, it was the best job in the world. Yeah. Presumably, just traveling around America, drinking whiskey with fascinating people, staying in nice hotels, it must have been the dream job.
It was a dream job. It really was. I look very fondly on those days. And I say that I worked for 2 years straight and I was always traveling. I worked for Glenlivet, I think, for about 7 years. It did not seem like that. Like, I thoroughly enjoyed it the whole time. It never, ever felt like a burden to have to go travel. Again, it was a time in life where I was single, no real responsibilities outside of making sure everybody was drunk and happy. You know, what's not to love about that?
So any particular, I don't know what you'll be able to tell me, but any particular adventures you had in any sort of corners of America that are particularly memorable?
There's lots. Lots I can't talk about. Lots I can't talk about. God, there's so many, Dan. It, like, one might jump out at me in a minute, but, you know, trying to think of some of the friendships that were developed, some of the places that I got to go to because people were like, "Oh my God, you're the brand ambassador." Okay, as a young man, probably one of the best things was because I did a little favor for somebody. I gave them a bottle of whiskey that didn't cost me anything. I was a representative of Glenlivet. It was a really high end bottle. I handed it over to them. About a week later, I get this invite to the Playboy Mansion.
There you go. I knew there'd be a story. There you go.
So I get an invite to the Playboy Mansion. It's the white party or something like that. Everybody shows up in white. And I showed up to that. And that was very interesting. And, of course, from my friend's point of view, they're like, "Oh, you know, that's amazing. You went to the mansion." It wasn't bad. I was a little disappointed, I have to be honest.
What was disappointing about it?
It was like any other party. I mean, you never actually went into the mansion. They had all these marquees outside. I didn't get to see the lagoon and all, whatever they call it, whatever, all that stuff. But it was just like any other party, to be honest. I didn't, you know, I'd been to a lot of parties. I was like, well, this is kind of just like any other party.
Yeah. So, have you been to all 50 states?
No, I have not been to the Dakotas.
Okay, either of them.
Either of them, North Dakota, South Dakota, and I think that is it.
So you've done Alaska?
No. So I actually get this. I haven't been to Hawaii, and which is incredible considering the show that I have. So I haven't done Hawaii, Alaska, both Dakotas, and Montana.
Okay. So for your new show, I mean, Montana feels like a place where Eco Lux would work.
It is on my list.
For Hawaii, that's a big part of their story.
Right.
So if anyone from the Hawaii Tourist Authority is listening to this podcast, season two is going to be shot whenever coronavirus ends. So
Exactly. Yeah. Nice plug.
Super. So you work for, have you worked for other brands beyond Glenlivet?
I consulted a little bit with White Mackay just before last year, mostly, or year before last. Sorry, I started just before, about 6 months before coronavirus. Did a little consulting with them, and I was on my own for a long time. I was consultant, so I actually did a lot of work for a lot of brands where they maybe didn't have an ambassador available in a certain market. You know, I was a good fill-in. They'd send me in there to tell the story with a smile on my face. So I've worked with several brands.
Yeah, very good. Now, look, you've got one of your many different roles at the moment. You're working with a couple of other whiskey folks.
Yeah,
in an enterprise called wonderfully the Dram Good Laddies. So yeah, tell me about the Dram Good Laddies.
Yeah, this is really exciting. So there's a couple of guys, there's three laddies. There's Ricky, Nikki, and Ali. So Nicholas Palacki, who I've actually known for a very long time. He's very well known in the Scotch whiskey industry. He worked for Willie Grant for a while. He has done his own thing with a whiskey dog. And he was actually appeared on CNBC many times as a whiskey investment advisor. Nicky's an amazing guy. I have a lot of respect for him. And then Ali is Alistair Menges. He's been around for a while too in the whiskey industry. And we all actually were doing stuff with White Mackay, you know, the year or 6 months previous to COVID. And of course, our job is being in front of people physically and talking about the brands and telling the stories and telling the jokes and standing up and being entertaining and engaging. And that all stopped. And it went to this format, right? So we thought, okay, it's going to be this way for a while. There's an opportunity there. We can see there's an opportunity business to business, client based, not from a brand point of view. So we created a company called the Dram Good Laddies. And what I was able to do, instead of just doing a Zoom situation like this, which is what a lot of people are doing, a lot of the brands are doing now, I was able to actually tap into the resources of the production team that I have out of Sydney, who made the television show, and really take the virtual experience to the next level, using green screens, using all the technology that the production team has in Sydney, so that all three of us are in different locations. Nikki is in New Jersey, I'm here in Washington, D.C. or Virginia, and Ali is actually in Texas. But through the magic of all this technology, our producer brings us all together, and we present a virtual tour of Scotland. So we've created this tour where we put ourselves in all these different places in Scotland, and you know, people love to watch it. We go to a distillery, we highlight the whiskey a little bit. It started off, we were going to do all whiskey. It's pure whiskey tour. And then we realized a lot of our clients, many people have a lot, might not all be whiskey drinkers. And a lot of their clients and who they were putting this on for client appreciation or employee appreciation, actually had a genuine interest in Scotland in general. So we're called the Dram Good Laddies. We do highlight some whiskies, but we do a virtual tour of Scotland for the most part.
So whereas normally a company would, you know, take their staff to Vegas for hitting their sales targets, or, you know, get them together in a corporate retreat in the mountains of Utah to, you know, make them all feel warm and fuzzy. Instead, they're hiring you guys, and you make it bespoke, you personalize it, and then you give them their tour of Scotland with private in-jokes and all that stuff.
Exactly. We call people out in the company. We you know, there's branding within the production. There was one instance where we actually one of the most fun instances was one of the clients who was being presented to has an apartment or a condo on a golf course in Arizona. And through the kindness of his heart, he was actually letting people use it during COVID who wanted to get away with their families and stuff like that. So we had some people take pictures of it, high-res pictures of it, and we inserted ourselves into his condo. Nice. So he didn't know it was coming. So we come on screen and we're all separate. We're like, hey, let's amalgamate, guys. Let's get together. How about Arizona? And we all show up in this condo. And the guys watching, they're like, hey, that's my condo. How the hell did they do that? So stuff like that is a lot more engaging than watching some, you know, just watching what the normal Zoom conversation is.
Yeah. And look, because obviously everyone's finding clever ways of getting through this pandemic and being innovative. Presumably companies have embraced this because it sounds, you know, I think of companies I've worked in where I've had big teams and I think, you know, would I do that sort of thing? And obviously you wouldn't do it normally because you don't need to, but
right.
It feels appealing. Have companies bought into this? You know what, this is a better idea than just boring Zoom meetings or doing nothing.
Yeah, we are, you know, we thought that there would be at least some intrigue there to hire us, but we're you know, business is good. There's some good, we're getting some repeat business, which is always great. And we're getting some big companies who are like, okay, we really like this idea. Let's do multiple events. And that's always good.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I guess it's a funny one because the pandemic's going to end at some point, one would hope.
Yeah.
Do you think there is a place where this stays?
I do, and I'll tell you why, because the companies, this might end, but the company's going to look and say, oh, I paid X amount of dollars to have three guys really, you know, entertain my 100 people, my 100 client base, or I could go back to spending $500,000 to take them down to Puerto Rico for the weekend. You know, maybe I'll only take 100 of them and the other 400, I think there'll almost be a hybrid version of it. I think it will still exist. I think it's made its mark, and it will always be an option.
Yeah.
I think it will always be an option, an affordable option for when that decision has to be made, where we have to cut, you know, companies might have to cut the purse strings here and there, then they'll do the virtual tour.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, there's a part of me that thinks I can't wait for life to go back to normal and just go back and doing all the things I used to do. And, you know, I'm going straight to Vegas as soon as the second shot of my vaccination has worked. And, you know, I'm going to go over to Scotland, do distillery tours. But then the other day we had some friends over, just one of my neighbours, once the stay-at-home orders ended in California, a neighbour came over, social distance garden stuff. We had dinner and then I pulled out some good whiskies and we did a sort of, I think a 15, a 16, an 18, and a 21 from four different distilleries. And he likes his whiskey. If we tried to do that in a bar, that's a $500 bar bill, maybe more. And him and I were saying, look, we've both got decent whiskey. Even when life goes back to normal, yes, we'll go out to a normal pub. But actually, I think there'll be some at-home stuff. So I do think, even though you can do things, I think there'll be a version where you get to do some of these weird pivoted things we've had to do will probably prevail.
Yeah, I think what used to be just the television time where it was a one-way conversation, the TV was speaking to you. You know, you go through life as life was normally, but there was always television and screen time. Where before it was a one-way conversation, I think now that it's a two-way conversation with whoever you want, that it's different. I think there's a place for it.
So what happens to you in terms of with the Drowned Good Ladies, when life goes back to normal, will you do a combination of virtual tours still for those who want them? But actually, if somebody wants to come to Scotland, you'll take them there as well.
Yeah. So two things. I think we'll always do the virtual tour. I would be really excited to actually do stage production of our show. Like, and it's like any big conference you would have went to in the past. There's always the big happy hour stage production. There's always entertainment in some way or the other. And I and the other laddies, Nikki and Ali, are really excited at the prospect of actually writing a stage show. Now, outside of that, we're already getting questions because we've done this virtual tour of some of these companies saying, all right, when things open up, would you guys be interested in, actually hosting our company back in Scotland? And I have a little experience doing it. Actually, I did it with my Richard Crawford Luxury Company a few years ago. Very small, very bespoke. I usually took anywhere from 6 to 8 people, which was very manageable. It was all very high-end and very curated experiences. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think there's probably a space for that with the three laddies.
So you'll when life goes back to normal, whenever whatever normal looks like, but when travel starts again, you'll be busy. You have to do potentially real trips, but then also you can start shooting your TV show again.
I've got to tell you, I'm so ready for it, Dan. I've already lined up. Like, we already have companies lined up to go shoot, right, when it opens up. A couple of different places. Norway, which I'm really excited about. Namibia, Mongolia, California. There's one in California that we're going to go visit. So I'm really excited. And we're lining. I don't want to wait till this is over and then try and line it all up, because then that's another 6 months. Yeah, so we're lining everything up with the thought process of when it opens up, then it's all already in play and ready to go. But for somebody who literally, you know, spends his life traveling, it's been very, very difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine. Norway, I've not been. I've done Denmark and Sweden, never been to Norway. But it appeals. I've been to Namibia. I covered a cricket tournament there when I was a sports journalist.
Oh, wow.
The most amazing place.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't. It was never on my radar before. And obviously, when I do these shows, we do a little research. When I did a little research in Namibia, and to be honest, I one of my favorite television shows that I watch is Ewan McGregor's Long Way Up, Long Way Down, Long Way Around on the motorcycles. He did, when he went Long Way Down, he went through Africa and Namibia and all that stuff. And when I saw that, I was like, yes, I got to go there. I got to see that with my own two eyes. Norway. I've been to Sweden. We did the Treehouse episode in Sweden, which will actually be in season two. It won't go into season one. But Norway, I'm so excited. Some of the excursions. And I don't know if you've seen, there was a commercial on TV where it was this tiny little island and there was a house smack bang in the middle of it. Forget what the commercial was. But very, very remote. But there's an experience like that up in Norway that I'm excited to go do.
So one house on an island.
On an island, yeah.
Yeah. Because I know there was I think in March last year, there was a thing going around on social media. It's like I don't know if it originated from a real thing, but it's like, do you want to go and spend 60 days on a lighthouse somewhere? I don't know if it was Scotland, actually. And it was like, you know, you've I think you have to make your own food. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it's like, because people were beginning to imagine what social distancing was, you want to just live on your own on a lighthouse. And I think the answer to most people is, yeah, I think we probably would.
You know, this goes back to my Glenlivet days. And when I was in California, I visited, there's a cheese that's made, it's the most, I believe it's the most western part of the United States, the 48 states. And as a lighthouse, and they make cheese, I forget, I was in San Francisco and you had to drive a couple hours to get to it. Would you happen to know the name off the top of your head?
No, I wouldn't, but I'll be Googling it after this.
Anyway, yeah, you got to Google. So it's a trip that you take. It was a dull day. There wasn't a lot of people around. You go out there and you visit the lighthouse. And it's a historical museum kind of thing. And they've got these books. They've got these logs of people who used to have to go to this lighthouse for weeks and months on end. And you see the log entries at the beginning, and you see the log entries like 5 and 6 months later. These people literally go crazy. Like, you can see it in their writing. It's so fascinating to see that, first of all, the handwriting gets crazy. And then the thought process of what they're writing down is fascinating. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. I think we just all, yeah, it's particularly when I speak to the whiskey folks, actually, because obviously there's plenty of people who've got jobs that involve engaging with others, but there's something about whiskey and bringing people together. And obviously the sorts of jobs you had where you could have spent 4 or 5 nights in any given week with 50 to 100 different people every night. And your job is to, you know, engage them and tell stories and all that stuff. It must be so hard to try and sort of, you know, replicate that on Zoom and not be around people when you're used to it.
Yeah, it's tough. The hardest part is the feedback. Like, you know, we're all entertainers, so to speak. So we all have our jokes and our lines that we know land, right? So we know, I'm going to use this one because, if the crowd's being difficult, this one always pulls them back in again. And you try it on Zoom, and there's no response. That was the hardest thing when I first did it. I was throwing these lines out, and normally I'm getting the feedback and, you know, not a thing, like dead silence. Like, do I move on? Do I wait till somebody says something? Like, it was really weird.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Now, the worst thing you can do is repeat a joke on Zoom. It doesn't.
Right, exactly. So what, just try and explain it. So what I'm saying is.
So look, talking of sort of people, I think this is a good moment for the last question of the podcast, which is, if you could drink any whiskey with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be, what would it be, and where would it be?
Oh, God. Jesus, that's always a tough one, right? So what whiskey would I drink, who would it be, and where would it be?
Yeah.
I think I would probably stick... God, I want to say Glenlivet, but it sounds like I'm pushing it so bad, and I'm not. It's just such an enjoyable drink. Glenlivet or Bovaria Caribbean Cask 14. That's the Caribbean. The 14-year-old Caribbean cask is an incredible whiskey. So let's pick that whiskey. Where would it be? I've completely fell in love with the Outer Hebrides, and I will probably go there and retire and write my memoirs if I can still remember everything. So we've got the place and we've got the whiskey. Who would it be? What person? And God, that's such a tough one. Such a tough one. Maybe, you know what? George Clooney.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. That's the first. 62 episodes in, first time we've had George Clooney. Go on. So why?
I think George Clooney, because he'd just be so cool to hang out with. We either would talk or we wouldn't, and it wouldn't matter. Just sit there, sip a whiskey, maybe smoke a cigar. He'd probably play some kind of trick on me because he's a trickster. But yeah, there you go. George Clooney, Bovaria 14 Caribbean Cask, the Hebrides.
Very good. He'll probably try and make you drink his tequila.
Yeah, that's all right. I would give it a shot. I'd tell him the truth if I liked it or not.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I don't think he cares now. He sold it for $1 billion to Diageo. So.
That's true. Yeah.
Brilliant. No, that's a great answer. That's a great answer. Brilliant. Look, Ricky, this has been exactly what I thought it would be. It's been fascinating. So thank you very much for being part of the show. And good luck. Hopefully next time, we can't see each other until this is over. So hopefully we'll see each other when your show's back on the road, you're doing tours again, you're doing whiskey tastings again, and we can share a Balvenie, a Glenlivet, or anything else together at some point in the future.
Well, look, mate, thanks for having me on, man. It's been a blast. You're a good guy. You're not a bad guy. So that's always fun. And just shameless plug, go watch Leave No Trace on Amazon Prime.
But make sure you watch the TV show, not the film.
Yeah, don't watch the movie.
I love scotch. 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 Yep.
And don't forget to not just follow us on Twitter and Instagram at US of Dramerica, but also ask us questions and comment and say nice things.
And please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if the mood takes you, you can leave us a review, as feedback is always welcome.
And drink whiskey. Slán tír.